We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this part of the show, we'll be talking about immigration. This is certainly something that we've talked about, approaching it in different ways with different guests in the past. And in this hour, we've put two people together that I think should give us an interesting conversation, giving us an opportunity to talk about the U.S.-Mexico border, which certainly is the focus for a lot of the debate about immigration right at the moment. But also we'll be taking something of an historical perspective and try to talk a little bit about how it is in this country we have thought about immigration and immigrants over time. And our two guests are Tyke Hendricks and Peter Schrag. Tyke Hendricks is editor for the California Report on KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. She's a lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and she spent more than a dozen years writing for newspapers, most of that time as a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. She's the author of a recent book that's titled The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport, Stories from the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands, and it is about the border and traveling that she has done across the border, stopping in different places that give her an opportunity to talk about different issues that have to do with the border. And our other guest, Peter Schrag, has for many years also been a journalist. He was the editorial page editor and also a weekly columnist for the Sacramento Bee, currently contributes to The Nation, Harper's, the LA Times. He is a visiting scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at University of California, Berkeley, and he is the author of the book Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. Both of these books are published by the University of California Press. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we hope people can do is be on target here with our topic and also try to be brief just so we can keep the program moving along. But questions, comments from listeners are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point you have comments, questions, you want to be involved in a conversation, you can just give us a call. And Tyke Hendricks, hello.
Hi there.
And Peter Schrag, hello.
Good morning.
Hey, thank you both very much. You know, when the books came in, I had this sort of crazy idea about putting the two of you together. And then when we found out, that you actually have done some appearances together. So this is not the first time that you've been doing this. I very much appreciate you both giving us some of your time.
Happy to.
And also, it's a little difficult having a three-way conversation where nobody can see anybody else. But if one of you is making a comment and the other would like to build on that, please feel free to go ahead and, if there's a lull, jump in. I'm not exactly sure where to start here, other than maybe I'll start with Peter Schrag, because I think that you make an important point in the book, and that is, as you look at the attitudes that people have had in this country about newcomers over time, they've really swung back and forth between periods where we're very open and periods where we've just slammed the door shut. What is it, do you think, that drives that?
Oh, many things. Certainly the economy is one thing, and we've seen that again now, and that's been the case for a good long time. The other thing, of course, is that our racial / ethnic attitudes change. We are ourselves somewhat ambivalent about who can be an American, who would be a good American, who would contribute to our society, and so on. And again, we see that even at this moment in our polls, where, for example, people will say, we support Arizona's SB 1070, the fairly draconian anti-immigrant legislation that was passed in Arizona last year. At the same time, they say, if you are an illegal immigrant, and you've paid your taxes, and you are not having committed a crime, and you behave yourself, you should have a right to become a citizen. So we have those ambivalence almost at the same moment.
Mm. It certainly seems to be the case that people now, when they talk about the issue of immigration or about people who are here who are not documented, the thing that they continue to talk about is the law. They talk about, well, And particularly when you talk about some kind of policy that perhaps would make it possible for people to be here legally or make some sort of path to citizenship, a lot of people keep coming back to this thing. They say, well, yes, but they broke the law in coming here. And do you think that actually this their concern really is about the law, or is that actually that gives them a good reason, but that's really not the reason?
Well, it's very hard, of course, to psychoanalyze hundreds of millions of people, but I would say in many cases the issue of breaking the law is probably something that covers a whole set of other attitudes having to do with ethnicity or with a job competition or whatever. But I think in some cases it's probably also true. But of course it hedges into, because they say, well, they're criminals. Well, they're not criminals. It is not a first-time undocumented immigrant is not a criminal. He or she may have violated the law, but that doesn't make him criminals.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Let me just jump in. I mean, I do think that people's discomfort with immigration and immigrants, and specifically with unauthorized immigration, has to do, in some cases, with our cultural differences and economic anxieties, but that issue of rule of law and sort of following the law strikes a chord for people. And when that sort of refrain of "what don't you understand about illegal" is sort of a reductionist way of looking at it, but it does strike a chord for people. I think one thing that I've heard Peter point out before is that, of course, our immigration laws are not handed down from the mountain on stone tablets. I mean, this is something that has evolved and changed over time. And when you have immigration laws that aren't sort of in sync with economic realities that impel people to migrate, then you do get people coming without legal authorization, and that there are ways to affect that and change that through making laws more in tune with what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm. You, the thing I think is interesting about your book, and I think here's a central idea, and maybe it also, this helps us to understand why making any kind of law at all is really difficult. Your point is that the border, it's not a clear, bright line. And that I think the point that you've tried to make is that there are people on both sides of this line that has been drawn that have ties. People go, for a variety of reasons, people go back and forth in terms of their culture, their background. A lot of these folks are really not all that different. And so that makes this whole business of saying, here's the line, and people on the one side are these people, and people on the other side are these people, and if you want to go across, you got to have special permission, you got to go at certain places and certain times. That the reality of it is just it makes it sound like that's not a place you can regulate that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we talk about immigration in this country, I mean, we often talk about the border and closing the border, sealing the border, and it struck me as a reporter covering immigration that the border was very much the focus of that conversation, and that the border had become almost a symbol of how we deal or don't deal with unauthorized immigration. And so I live in California. I live, which is a border state, but I'm in Northern California, and I went to the border region and spent time along the length of the border to really try to understand, what is it in fact on the ground, and to understand the lives of people who live there. And as you say, there are millions of people, in fact, who have binational lives that straddle that border. It is a real international boundary, and nations have the right to enforce their boundaries, but it's a place that's much more complex and nuanced and fascinating, I think, than just a symbol about how well we control immigration. And so my book, through the stories of people who live on both sides of the border, looks not so much just at immigration, but at all the many other aspects of the trade and the commercial interactions, of environmental issues and air and water that flow across the border, of people who work on one side and live on the other, or have family on the other side, or go to the dentist in one country and go to school in the other country. This kind of thing that happens on a daily basis from, you know, from Brownsville to Tijuana.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note that I guess the title of your book, "Wind Doesn't Need a Passport," was actually a quote from somebody who was an environmental official in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that it, again, just another way of expressing the idea that there, what happens on one side affects what happens on the other side, and it's not a one-way thing, that it, that it's very much a back-and-forth sort of a thing.
That's right.
I think one of the real strengths of Taiki's book is that she makes it clear that the border, more than being a line, is a region, and with all kinds of shared activities, problems, issues, and as she said, people who live on one side and go to the dentist on the other side, and that it is ever more a region, and there's and drawing a line through it is a fairly artificial kind of effort.
I want to ask Peter Schrag whether you think that because the focus of immigration now, or that is the concerns people have about illegal immigration, is so much about the U.S.-Mexico border. Does, and when you look back in the past, where people were coming here from other countries, from Europe and Asia and elsewhere, that it was much more the case that when you came, you were here, and that was it. There was no going back. And that there now today, particularly again along the border, there's people go back and forth. That it's a very different sort of a thing. The transition isn't quite so abrupt and quite so permanent as maybe it once was. And does that make it now more difficult for us to think about this and talk about it than it was in the past?
Well, one of the things that's of course that we've learned in the past 25 years is that most of the efforts that we've made to, quote-unquote, control the border, seal the border, whatever the phrase is, have in fact had very unintended consequences. The toughening of border enforcement in the last 20 or 25 years, the addition of many more border patrol agents, the building of fences, walls, bollards, the electronics, the surveillance, all of that stuff, for much of that time, the effect has, in fact, been paradoxical. It's increased the resident illegal population in this country because people who used to go back and forth, particularly farm workers who came seasonally and then went back out of season, would instead of course, as it became harder and more expensive to make those crossings, would simply stay put here, would send for their families, and would become effectively permanent residents in this country. So we've had this ironic, and Janet Napolitano, when she was the governor of Arizona, she's now the secretary
Homeland Security.
Homeland Security. I'm blocking on these things. anyways, Homeland Security once said that, show me a 50-foot wall, and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. And so a lot of these things have not worked as they were intended. The same thing is true with NAFTA. It's true with other things. But it's certainly true that historically, most people, when they came, they stayed put, though a great many, interestingly enough, did go back, even in the late part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. They went back to Poland. They went back to Italy. So it's been a very complicated picture for much of that time, but it's certainly true that the efforts now to seal the border, close the border, have rarely worked the way they were intended.
And I think it's worth just noting when we're talking about illegal immigration a couple of points. One is the majority of people who come into the country without, well, who become illegal immigrants here are people who crossed that U.S.-Mexico border. But a quarter to a third, maybe more, are actually people who came in on a legal visa and overstayed it, and all the fencing in the world isn't going to address that issue. The other thing to point out is that over the last few years, that illegal border crossing has dropped substantially by well more than half. And I think, you know, there's a complex sort of admixture there of greatly increased enforcement. We're spending five times on border enforcement what we did a decade ago, but also very much the recession and the drop-off in jobs in this country. But as Peter said, the hardening of the border has made it much harder for people to go back and forth to Mexico on a cyclical, seasonal basis. So even though crossings have declined, the number of undocumented immigrants in this country has not dropped substantially. It's about 11 million people now by the estimates of the Pew Hispanic Center, down from about 12 million a few years ago. But those are people who are in a situation where they're not able to get legal status in this country. There's not really a path to do that at this point, and they don't feel like they can return. I mean, those who are Mexican don't feel like they can return to Mexico because it's so much harder to get back into this country.
I have a caller we get right to, I promise. I just want to follow up, though. Do you think, or does anybody really know, if you look at the decline in people who are here, who are undocumented, you mentioned the two things that are always mentioned, and maybe it depends on where you want to, you know, what you really want, one really thinks is more important, whether it is the downturn in the U.S. economy, so that means less opportunity for people to work, or a tougher border enforcement. Is it more one or the other, or is it a little bit of both?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both. I think, you know, it's easy for, I mean, the government will point to the enforcement and say, look, it's succeeding. I think we may not really know until the economy picks up again and see what happens to illegal immigration rates at that point. You know, conversationally, I have spoken to people here who are undocumented who acknowledge that it's harder to cross the border now. So I think that is a part of it. But
historically, it's always been the economics has always played a large role. Not only economics in this country, are there jobs? Are employers looking for people? Even looking for people abroad? But also, what's the economy in the sending country?
Mm-hmm.
The Irish potato famine drove a great many people to this country because they were starving in Ireland. The same thing was true to some extent in continental Europe. Obviously, there were political revolutions, all kinds of other things. But a lot of it, of course, had to do with the comparative economic conditions of the two countries.
One more quick point that I think is important to make, certainly in terms of immigration today, a lot of it has to do with the not only economic conditions here and over there, but the economic ties between the two countries. And as we, our economy penetrates in a sort of a global way into other countries, or as we get involved in wars and intervention in other countries, that often leads to refugee flows, but also immigrant flows coming back this way. So it's hard to sort of disentangle those strands in a global world.
Let me introduce our guests for the benefit of anyone who might have just tuned in. Tyke Hendricks is editor for the California Report on KQED, public radio in San Francisco. She has also written for a number of newspapers, including the San Francisco Chronicle, and she is author of the recently published book, The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport, Stories from the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. Also with us, Peter Schrag. For many years, he was the editorial page editor for the Sacramento Bee, currently contributes to The Nation, Harper's, L.A. Times. He's a visiting scholar at the Institute for Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley, and is author of the book Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America, both these books published by University of California Press. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, starting with someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm not sure. The previous caller may have brought this up, but the border in this area is something of an anomaly. It didn't exist for most of the history of the region. The Southwest had been the northern part of Mexico, and these people have moved freely across that border, or non-existent border, and till well after the independence of Texas in, what was it, 1836?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Relatively recently. And what we're really trying to do is interrupt a traditional population flow back and forth.
Well, that's...
I get into a little bit of that history in my book. as you say... you know, much of the Southwest, you know, from Texas to California, was once part of Mexico. Texas declared its independence in 1836. We had the U.S.-Mexican War in 1846 to 48, and at that point, the U.S. took claim to, you know, to pretty much all of that territory, which was about half of Mexico's land at the time, and with the drawing of the border where it is now, with a little jog through Arizona and New Mexico in 1853 that gave us a little more land to run a railway across. You know, there were tens of thousands of people who had been formerly Mexican citizens, nominally many of them Indians, but others as well, who then all of a sudden were Americans. And but as you say, a lot of the patrolling of the border really didn't happen until probably starting in the 20s and 30s, but in a pretty relaxed way up until more recent times. And it was much easier to cross back and forth. And so there's a long history, really a century of history, I would say, dating back to the Mexican Revolution around 1910, of Mexican presence in this country in agricultural work, going up to Illinois, to Chicago for industrial jobs and meatpacking jobs, railroad jobs. And so, that is an integral part of the history of the U.S. and Mexico.
The original, our original big immigration control laws of the 1920s, which set quotas, which set national quotas for much of the world, did not set quotas for the Western Hemisphere. In fact, we didn't even think of Mexicans in those days as immigrants. So that, in theory at least, there never was a quota on Mexico. There became an effective quota because we made visa fees and some other fees prohibitive. But the immigration laws of the 1920s, the big national origins quota laws, did not, in fact, exempted all of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. Just to, again, I want to thank the caller. Just real quick, I want to ask Taiki. One can only be a citizen of one or the other. But that's a legal distinction. If you talk to people and try to get a sense of what they feel their identity is, do they feel strongly one way or another, or is that not even something that people really even bother with?
People in the borderland.
People in the borderland, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think it is actually possible to have dual citizenship. Mexico, about a decade, dozen years ago, made it possible for people who were Mexican-born, who had taken citizenship, you know, naturalized in the U.S. or elsewhere, to reclaim their Mexican citizenship. So there are people who have dual citizenship. There are people who are Mexican-born who have U.S. green cards and live in that region. And there are Mexicans who have a border crossing card. They live in the border region. They have ties there, but they have obtained a card from the U.S. government that's they call it a laser visa. It's a little identity card that says you can come and, you know, for a few days in this border region for visiting or shopping, so forth. It's not an immigration visa. Yes, there. As one of my sources pointed out, people in Mexico in the border region are derided by Mexicans further south and in the capital as too agringados, too gringified, you know, because they live too close to the U.S. and they speak a sort of a Spanglish sometimes with too much Americanism thrown in. But he said, you know, when you cross the border into the United States, you know for sure you're not a gringo. Yes, there are distinctions, and there's a distinction between being Mexican-American, Tejano, for example, and being Mexican. But in places like South Texas, especially where the deepest roots of this kind of Mexicano presence in the United States exists, has gone back the longest, I mean, there's very much a kind of a blended culture there and a very a Tejano Mexicano culture that is very much a part of the American fabric, though we may not think of it that way.
All right. Let's talk.
In fact, yes. You get traces of that well into the United States. I mean, in L.A. or in other parts of California or Texas or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to draw a line and say, you know, this is the. I mean, even the border region is somewhat amorphous, wouldn't you say, Taiki?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's both. I mean, the dividing line is real. The dividing line, I think, helps define that region. It's attracted, you know, industrial growth and so forth because of the proximity to the other country. But there is also this constant flow back and forth and this very, you know, distinctive blend that is the border.
We have another caller here to get to. Let's go talk with them. This is somebody who is in Champaign, here, Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Listen, I got a couple of points. The first point is, you know, it sounds like your guests are drawing a little bit of an arbitrary point in the sand historically with respect to, you know, talking about areas of the United States that used to be Mexico. Because, after all, what is Mexico? Mexico is an arbitrarily drawn geographical area drawn by European immigrants. In other words, Spanish imperialism. So there was no Mexico. Okay, that's the first point. The second point has to do with the economic pressures that can create resentment to illegal immigrants. Your guests have spoken only so far about employment competition. But the fact is that there's a heck of a lot of resentment amongst a lot of Americans to the fact that American laws seem to require that all social services to which Americans themselves have to compete are also allowed to illegal immigrants, even though they're illegal. You know, you can go and get American health care, for example, which is a big crisis in this country, health care, and it has to be given away to illegal immigrants. Some of those immigrants do, in fact, pay taxes, so even if they are illegal, so I think that mitigates some of that, obviously, as well as some of the social services issues. But I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about that aspect of the economic pressures on the immigrant situation. Thank you very much. I'll take the answers off, take the comments offline.
Okay.
It's partly correct that that certainly, for example, that children of illegal immigrants have a constitutional right to go to public schools. But illegal immigrants don't have a right to a lot of social services, and I think there's a little bit of confusion about that. A lot of social services are specifically only eligible, are only available to legal residents. So a lot of illegal immigrants, yes, emergency health care. Obviously, if there's somebody bleeding on the street, you have to take him to an ER, no matter what his legal status is. But a lot of other health care is not available to illegal residents.
And I mean, I think that those you know, concerns and anxieties about the fiscal costs of illegal immigration are real, and especially at a time when budgets are getting cut and, you know, lots of people are feeling economic pressure and out of work and so forth. As Peter said, you know, there are in fact many services that are very explicitly denied to illegal immigrants, and that was very explicit in the Obama health care reform and so forth. There are some, you know, municipal governments who will say, look, you know, for public health reasons or whatever, you know, we're not going to be checking people's legal status when we provide services. I was one of the chapters of my book. So I spent time in different spots on the border and looked at different issues, and each chapter has sort of a different cast of characters. And one of the chapters is looking at the healthcare question in border regions, because I did have a sense that, look, you know, hospitals are bearing a brunt here of taking care of illegal immigrants who don't have insurance in this country, and that is a real cost. And so I spent some time in southern Arizona in hospitals there and looked at the kind of the healthcare dynamics down there in a border community. And I was actually, I mean, it's not that the costs don't exist. And in fact, you know, we all, as human beings, we all have fiscal costs, right? We need paved roads and healthcare and education and so forth. So wherever you are, you will incur some fiscal costs on your government. But I was actually a little surprised in my conversations with hospital administrators there in Arizona to find that they said yes. You know, probably maybe 25%, 30% of our charity care goes to foreign nationals, to primarily Mexicans, who many of them are probably here without authorization. And that is a real component of it. But we, you know, there are a lot of uninsured Americans, too, that we're providing charity care to. And they also said, you know, we also see Mexicans in this border region as sometimes paying customers who come here for elective surgery and pay out of pocket for that. We see people with these sort of binational lives who go back and forth, and if you get sick here, you present at our hospital and we take care of you. And then they were also coming up with some ways to kind of reduce the costs by, you know, building relationships with Mexican hospitals so that patients could be sent back to Mexico sooner, so that the Mexican hospitals could do a better job of caring for their own critical cases, premature babies and so forth, cases that had previously sometimes been sent to the Arizona hospitals. So there was those fiscal costs are real, and I think that they're very real in people's sort of sense of the political dynamic around immigration. But in fact, in southern Arizona, northern Sonora, and probably in other border communities, there was a more complicated sort of interaction around health care and who gets it and how it gets paid for.
One of the things that's interesting about costs also is that many of the things that have been said about the costs of the social service costs or whatever of servicing illegal Mexican or Latino immigrants were said 100 years ago. About Eastern European immigrants who also are said to be great burdens on the social services, then, of course, mostly private, how their kids couldn't learn at school. They were also a burden on the schools. They were, of course, too prone to crime, anarchism, now terrorism. So a lot of the things that were said a century ago and earlier about Eastern European immigrants, Southern European immigrants, is what's being said now about Mexicans.
Let me just very quickly introduce the two guests for anybody who might have just joined us. Peter Schrag, for many years, was editorial page editor at the Sacramento Bee. He's visiting scholar at the Institute for Governmental Studies at University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of the book Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. Tyke Hendricks is editor for the California Report on KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. She's a lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. She spent more than a dozen years at a number of newspapers, most of them at the San Francisco Chronicle. She is author of the book The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport, Stories from the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. University of California Press is the publisher of both of these books. And questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Tyke, I really am interested. You just touched on one of the stories in the book that you deal with, that the fact that, and it goes back to this idea that there are relationships, concerns that cross the line, that there are people who are involved in healthcare, doctors, nurses, clinics, hospitals, on both sides of the border, that end up treating people that go back and forth. And certainly if the wind doesn't need a passport, well, viruses don't need them either. Mm-hmm. And that I think it's really interesting how people have really said, how the healthcare people on both sides have said, look, we're in the same business. We're treating some of the same patients. How can we work together to try to provide care to people who need it? And I think that's another really interesting example of how people on both sides of the line work together because they have common concerns.
And I ran into that in other areas as well. I mean, I certainly saw it with regard to sort of in South Texas, in the McAllen-Reynosa area, kind of mutual sort of promotion of economic development in the two countries, realizing that, you know, your economic well-being affects ours. And I also saw it in my work along the sort of the Baja California border and around the Colorado River with environmental issues. And they're sort of a core of scientists and environmental advocates who are reaching out across the border and working with their colleagues on the other side to say, look, you know, the water in the Colorado, like, you pollute it on one side, we drink it on the other, and the air pollution blows, you know, from... There was a case where a couple of U.S. companies had built power plants, natural gas-fired power plants in northern Mexico around Mexicali to generate electricity for the U.S. market primarily. And was easier to get the permitting, easier to, you know, buy the land and pay for the labor and so forth in Mexico, and the environmental standards weren't quite so strict. So you put the plants on the Mexican side, but then you have these air quality managers in the Imperial Valley in California saying, hey, wait a second, we have the highest rate of asthma, childhood asthma in our state. And if you had put those power plants on our side of the border, just, you know, 10 miles away, the plants would have had to mitigate all of the emissions that they produced and offset those. And that's not happening now, but we're still breathing those emissions over here. So how can we find ways, you know, jointly to sort of roll up our sleeves and figure out some common solutions? And I think one of the inspiring things for me in reporting and writing this book was meeting people like that who were really in a very practical way sort of jointly looking for solutions. The environmentalists on the river saying, you know, how can we buy up water rights from Mexicali Valley farmers? How can we convince the water managers in Arizona and California to give a little more water to nature, so that, you know, endangered species have a little more habitat, even if it's on the Mexican side of the border in the Colorado River Delta. And I think that there's there's maybe a model for us on other policy issues to look at that kind of practical approach to saying, you know, our futures are entwined here, and we need to find solutions that work for both countries because the outcome will affect both of us.
Mm-hmm. David, there's a very wise man named Robert Pastor who has proposed essentially creating a North American community, a little bit like the EC, that would deal with, and there would be Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., that would deal with a great many of these common issues in a more formal institutional basis. That's not going to go anywhere for a while, but it seems to me for the long run, and given what Taiki has found in her reporting, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, you say that wouldn't be likely to go anytime soon. I have a feeling that it would be actually quite a long time, particularly I think there would be a lot of people here in the United States that would resist that.
Oh, absolutely. But that's there were also a lot of people in – I mean, yes, of course. But eventually there are so many common issues that have to be addressed commonly, and you may not be able to do that all at once. You may have to do it incrementally. But I would guess that within 40 or 50 years, our children or our grandchildren will see something like that.
Right. Well, let's talk with someone here in Danvers calling on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Two separate questions related to agricultural community. A basic first step to help with the immigration situation would be to have a work visa system that works. A lot of the employers of immigrants say that the work visa system is almost non-functional. I think it's a H-2A, if I'm right, visa. The government's trying to push this E-Verify system, but it is so cumbersome. The employer has to go to 4 different agencies in the right order, and it's almost unworkable. I think it was in the 50s and 60s we used to have a system of braceros or something, and now with all the computers we have, we can't even run a visa system.
Peter, did you want to?
Well, I just had a laugh at his remark about we have computers and the system doesn't work. And of course, E-Verify is also very error-prone. We did have the Bracero program that started in World War II when we were very short of particularly farm labor. And it worked, but it also had a great many problems. And part of the big wave of Mexican immigration in this country actually was triggered by the Bracero program when it ended. So it had problems, but it also, of course, solved some problems for a while for farmers.
Mm. Well, that I suppose that gets to this question of, you know, why is it that given that we have both, we seem to have group people who want to work, who would want to come here to the United States to work, and we have work that needs to be done, and people apparently who are willing to employ them, why can't we somehow work out a way for that to happen, for people to come to work?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, you know, there are certainly political dynamics in the way that immigration is used as a sort of a political wedge issue that have complicated that. The other thing that has complicated it in the last, sort of during this Obama presidency, is just the way that the recession really impacted, you know, the United States. And it sort of made an immigration deal that would you know, liberalize immigration become a real non-starter. I think the Bracero program had issues and problems in terms of sort of workers were tied to an individual job, and it sort of left them open to exploitation from their bosses. There are folks who have thought a lot about how is there a way we can do a temporary worker visa that is, you know, not prone to exploitation, that would allow people some what they call portability, the ability to move to another job. That is, a possibility. Other folks say, look, there's no such thing as a temporary worker program. People come and some of them will want to go home, but some of them will want to stay, and are you going to make provision for that? So So there are a lot of complex questions about how you reform immigration, but there also is some pretty smart thinking about how to do it. Mm-hmm. And the political will, you know, hasn't been there, and through this presidency or the previous presidency. So what we're seeing actually is sort of in the absence of a functioning U.S. immigration policy that a lot of the decision-making has kind of descended to the state and local level with laws being made in places like Arizona, Utah, Georgia, that are in many cases more restrictive in dealing with immigrants and immigration. But then on the other hand, you see in some other places a kind of a pushing back in a more sort of liberalizing way, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, challenging this Secure Communities program, which is a federal program that requires local police departments and jails to provide information about arrested people to immigration authorities, potentially turn over folks who are deportable to the federal government, even if they, you know, haven't been convicted of a crime on the local level. And so there's some pushback there. So what we have is this very fragmented response to immigration in the absence of a federal.
And again, there's enormous ambivalence. And I mean, a lot of states, about 10 or a dozen states, like California, for example, provide in-state tuition to undocumented immigrants, meaning that which is much cheaper than out-of-state tuition. And there's just been a Supreme Court case which essentially allowed those laws to stand. So at the same time, California, for example, and other states will provide in-state tuition to undocumented immigrants but won't give them driver's licenses. Now, you tell me what the consistency there is. So we have that. But I think beyond that, David, there's also, even politics aside and all of the nativism and all the rest of it that goes into it, it's very hard, even if there were no political issues involved, to devise an immigration policy for this country at this moment that would seem to be entirely workable.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated. It's very difficult. Whatever you do is likely to have unintended consequences. We've learned that over the years. So it's not just politics, though it certainly is partly politics, that stands in the way.
Mm-hmm. We have I have an email from someone. This I think, in a sense, you've touched on some of these points already. But I think that the person here again is raising the question of why it is if you're concerned with people who are here who are not documented, why not put the onus on people who would employ them rather than all of the effort that would go into trying to determine if someone was here illegally and then to deport them. I think that's sort of the big thing. Where do you place most of your emphasis, on the individual who is here without documents or on a person that maybe make it possible for the person to be here because they're employing them, perhaps knowing that they are not, they're undocumented?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've tried that. I mean, that was part of the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. It's part of federal policy now, is to essentially impose sanctions on employers who employ undocumented immigrants. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, just to jump in. I mean, I think there has been a subtle and in some cases sort of not widely reported shift, though. I mean, under the Bush administration, you saw Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the ICE agents, you know, these big high-profile raids on meatpacking plants and other things where they were arresting the immigrants themselves, charging them with identity fraud in some cases and, felonies and really putting the onus on those workers and long sort of protracted investigations of employers that in many cases didn't really go very far. There I think has been a bit of a shift in the last couple of years that, and Julia Preston in the New York Times had a piece a couple weeks ago that pointed to the Obama administration focusing more on the employers, that they're not doing these big sort of headline-making raids, but that they are actually prosecuting employers who are, more unscrupulous in terms of who they hire and how they treat their workers, and exploiting people because they're undocumented. So that is beginning to be a shift. I think that, the E-Verify is something that was mentioned before. This would be an electronic system to verify whether you have legal work authorization in this country. It's something that all of us, citizen or immigrant, would be subjected to, as we are now to a more of a paper version. When you apply for a job, you have to fill out an I-9 form and present some documents to prove, that you are legal here. That has been an even more error-prone system, but it hasn't really been enforced. So, I think it's fair to say that focusing on the workplace side of this is probably got to be a component of whatever immigration reform takes place.
And I think one thing that has not been discussed almost at all is more vigorous enforcement of the labor laws, the wages and hours laws, and so on, that would protect both American workers and would very much discourage the hiring of illegal immigrants.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop there. I appreciate the both of you sharing the time with one another. Both books are worthy of a close reading. So again, we'll say if you're interested in something of a portrait of life along the border, look for the book The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport by our guest Tyke Hendricks. She's editor for the California Report on KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. She is a lecturer at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. And Ms. Hendricks, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure.
And Peter Schrag, he is visiting scholar at Institute for Governmental Studies at University of California, Berkeley. Many years he was the editorial page editor at the Sacramento Bee, also contributes to The Nation, Harper's, LA Times. His book is Not Fit for Our Society, Immigration and Nativism in America. And both these books published by University of California Press. Peter Schrag, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was fun. Thank you.